I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Jim Bailey. He's a physician and professor of medicine and preventive medicine at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center in Memphis, where he directs the Center for Health System Improvement. He's author of the novel The End of Healing, and he will be giving a talk tomorrow, Wednesday, the 8th of July, titled Dante and the Hero's Quest for Healing. It's in the Junior Common Room at St. John's College. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So this is a book about the many ways in which the healthcare system in this country is broken. Tell us a little bit about your own story. What kind of ideals you had when you chose to be a doctor?
Well, you know, like most young physicians, when I was a young physician, like my protagonist in the story, I wanted to do the things that made people well. You know, I really had great ideals of helping promote wellness and fitness and helping people avoid illness and suffering and all that can go with that. So my experience was a bit like my protagonists in the story. You know, you have to write about the things that you know if you want to write well. I discovered that the system as it is in America doesn't always work for good, and that's a story that people in America need to understand if they want to protect themselves and their loved ones and get the kind of health care they need most.
Now, the protagonist in your book is named Dr. Don Newman, and he ends up taking a course of study from a doctor who's very critical of the American system. And one of the discussions that they have is about the difference between advancing knowledge and advancing health, which maps onto the difference between being able to diagnose somebody and to actually make them better. Can you explain this to us?
Sure. You know, in America, we're fascinated with technology. And in fact, that's true all over the world. People are so excited about gene therapy and about x-rays and MRIs and all the wonderful diagnostic tests we have. And doctors, like most of the American public, also get very excited about those new technologies and those wonderful tests that we can get. But what researchers have discovered is that almost all diagnosis, more than 80%, comes from old-fashioned history taking. And most of the rest of diagnosis comes from physical exam. So most of what really helps us figure out what's wrong with people comes from old-fashioned things, history and physical. And today, those things are often given short shrift. Instead, we just order another X-ray or CT scan, often with the danger of lots of radiation. And when we practice medicine in that way, not only can people be harmed by the tests themselves, well, in fact, often their chance of being harmed by a test is higher than their chance of being benefited from it. So that's part of the downside to a high technology sort of medical practice like we have in the U.S. today. Too little history taking and too much dangerous testing.
It goes back farther than that, too. You write about something that many of us don't really, it's a distinction that many of us don't know, which is that while antibiotics have surely saved a lot of lives, I mean, I'm alive today because of antibiotics, and a lot of people listening are, as great or greater than that are really basic advances in public health like chlorination.
Well, it's interesting. If you ask doctors what has conquered the infectious disease problem that used to be the major source of mortality worldwide, U.S. just like everywhere else, they'll tell you, oh, it was antibiotics. But what my young protagonist discovers, and what virtually every young student who studies public health and the history of public health learns, is that it wasn't antibiotics at all that conquered infectious diseases in America. The mortality rates from infectious diseases had already been reduced by 20 times before antibiotics and vaccination came along. And the thing that really conquered infectious diseases was hygiene, was clean water and better sanitary practices and isolation of the sick and those sorts of things that are very old-fashioned but very effective in preventing the spread of disease. So tuberculosis is one of the examples that my young scholar learns about. And even tuberculosis was largely conquered before we got the wonderful medications like streptomycin that many people attribute the conquering of the tuberculosis epidemic in the world. But it ends up it wasn't really the anti-tuberculosis medicines that conquered tuberculosis. It was reducing crowding in cities and isolating people, taking them out of the general public if they were sick with tuberculosis.
Your book is a profound indictment not only of the medical system, but also of medical education. What are some of the things wrong with medical education in the U.S.?
Well, I have to say there's also a lot right. You know, medical education is still primarily apprentice style, and doctors learn from other doctors and nurses and in practice most of what they do. But I have to say we can do better. History taking, for example, which is all about stories, learning someone's story and why they have chosen the path they've chosen, what are the things going on in their lives, what are the things that have contributed to and are at the roots of their condition. History taking still isn't given enough emphasis. And by way of that, young doctors learn well about people and why they make the decisions they make by studying stories. And as you know, our doctors mostly study science. They study the tests, the diagnostic tests that we can do in the laboratory. So much of the emphasis in modern healthcare is on laboratory medicine, laboratory testing. But the reality is that most diagnosis and most healing happens through history taking and counseling. So we can do more to help our doctors be good counselors and history takers and to understand the importance of story.
The bottom line here in the system where it's broken, as mm-hmm. everywhere in society where we seem to have a big problem, is summed up by the phrase, follow the money. When you follow the money in healthcare, where does it lead?
Well, Americans get what they pay for, and they pay a tremendous amount, double what any other country's population pays per person. They pay for lots of technology and lots of what we call in healthcare, the healthcare research field, rescue medicine. In other words, in America, we wait until things have gotten really bad, and then we send people to the emergency room, and we pull out all the stops to bring them back from the brink of death. That's a very expensive way to go. Of course, the only place in America you can really get free care is in the emergency room, the most expensive place of all. So it's a really crazy approach. Wait till someone's near death and perhaps can't even be saved, and then spend every bit of money we can, rather than starting with an emphasis on preventive and primary care, and preventing that emergency in the first place through low-cost, very safe, simple, and appropriate therapies that are readily available. So when my young protagonist and his friends, a surgeon and a nurse practitioner that are in this graduate program with him, when they follow their teacher's advice and follow the money, they find themselves in some interesting places, including Wall Street and in the halls of Washington, and they discover that there are industries out there ready to take advantage of this horrendous rescue care situation and effectively trade people's health for profit. And so they track down the ways that the various industries in healthcare are routinely trading people's health for profit. And they discover that the way that we're paying for healthcare, willy-nilly, we pay for whatever is asked for, is leading to a situation where people are often, not occasionally, but often harmed because of this profit-driven approach and this emphasis on technology, procedures, and emergency care.
At the same time, you indicate that this system, this very system you're talking about, is so bloated and greedy that it's sowing the seeds of its own destruction. What do you mean by that?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, this is my protagonist's viewpoint. I don't know if I would claim it myself, but perhaps I would. My protagonist sees that this current system that we have in America is unsupportable. Right now, he learns that we're spending 20% of our economy on healthcare. 20%, one in five of our dollars on healthcare. And much of that is going to scam artists. Now, the scam artists are often hidden in clothing and in situations and industries where we least suspect. But routinely, Americans pay lots for things that don't contribute to health. So part of what he discovers is that there's plenty of money for good health care for everyone that's being spent in the system. The problem is it's being allocated in the wrong places, and people are routinely getting scammed, getting offered therapies and treatments and procedures, both through the traditional healthcare system and the non-traditional alternative medicine system, that do little or nothing to contribute to health, or often can even contribute to harm.
So how is this sowing the seeds of the downfall of the corporate health monster?
Well, that's a good question. To answer you directly, the way it has potential to do that is through the weight of its own cost. I think the danger is that as people become aware of where and how their money is being wasted, they may make rash decisions to decide, for instance, that, okay, we can only afford good health care for the rich, not knowing that this idea of good health care itself is the problem. Or we might decide that we need to do away with the insurance industry entirely. Or we might decide that our hospitals can no longer afford to see people on an emergency basis who don't have insurance to pay. There are a whole bunch of ways that the system, if it goes on as it is now and with the aging of the population, will not be able to sustain the level of services that it's provided in the past. So our choices are to either have the system crumble, have our hospitals close, and essential services like primary care in the community become even more difficult to find, or we can make some aggressive choices to reform the system and invest our money where it can actually do good.
And where would that be?
Well, I think first and foremost in primary and preventive care. Right now, it's very hard to find good primary and preventive care, though you can always find help of some kind in an emergency room. We need to do more to make the care people need most that can prevent them needing in an emergency room and needing the hospital. We need to do more to make that accessible. And that can lead to a more sustainable healthcare system. One example I think that might help, a community right near where I live, but there are many communities like this all around the country, that's fairly low income. It has more dialysis centers than primary care clinics. And one of the reasons for that is this rescue care approach. In other words, instead of protecting people against end-stage kidney disease, we don't do anything up front to prevent that easily preventable condition. And instead, we pay $70,000 to $100,000 a year for each person whose kidneys fail, rather than paying the $5 a month that it would take to pay for the hypertension medicine that would prevent kidney failure. So it's insupportable to continue to pay for end-stage kidney disease for an increasing number of our population. It ends up being far better to prevent that harm in the first place. And that's part of what my protagonist discovers.
We're talking to Dr. Jim Bailey about his novel, The End of Healing. And the novel really covers the full range of problems in the medical system and the larger society, including obesity and cosmetic surgery and unnecessary procedures, and excessive paperwork and the health insurance system and drug problems. And then the most basic thing of all, the impossibility of following the famous maxim, do no harm. And I wanted to ask you, in your experience as a young doctor, did you find yourself in similar positions to that of your fictional character where you were doing basically protocols that you felt did more harm than help to the patient?
I have to say that almost every young physician experiences that. For the last 20 years, I've been working in the medical school here in Memphis, working with young doctors, and in many ways, this is their story. Virtually every young doctor, in my experience, at some point in their career, realizes that they're in a place where they're doing or being asked to do what they view as more harm than good. So I think that's often a routine that is encouraged by what I call the rescue care system that we've adopted, where we wait until that stroke has happened, like with the middle-aged woman that my protagonist encounters in the early days of the second year of his residency training. And we encounter those patients for whom we've waited too late, and there's very little hope of meaningful recovery. And yet our system continues to churn out often needless interventions without regard to whether those interventions can do good at that point or not. Certainly, all the waste in healthcare doesn't have to do with that harm we sometimes do to patients at the end of their life, prolonging lives against the wishes of patients and their families sometimes, or doing procedures that are part of the routine but aren't well evidence-based. A good example of that is all the cardiac procedures that are routinely done to check things out, to make sure it's not, there's not dangerous coronary disease. Well, each year in the U.S., there are thousands. My protagonist estimates 50 to 100,000 heart bypass surgeries a year, where the chest breastbone is split open and the plumbing of the coronary arteries is rerouted. And for out of roughly 500,000 of those surgeries a year in the U.S., somewhere between 50,000 and 100,000 of those are unnecessary and inappropriate. So those sorts of harms, unnecessary procedures, are fairly routine in this country, and they're costly, and they're harmful. So we as consumers need to be more attentive to both what are the goods that our healthcare system can do, and what are the most important of those goods, but also where is there danger for harm, and to be savvy consumers so that we and our families get the care we need most. This is the challenge really for every family in America, to become savvy consumers and understand what are the sorts of care and the sorts of therapies that are most likely to benefit them, and where is there most danger for harm. That's really the journey that my young protagonist goes on, and he offers people the opportunity to see through his eyes and discover both the good and the ill in our healthcare system, so that we can, each and every one of us, contribute to both ourselves and our families getting the care we need most.
Jim Bailey is a physician and professor of medicine and preventive medicine at the University of Tennessee Health Science Center in Memphis, where he directs the Center for Health System Improvement. He's author of the novel The End of Healing, and he will be giving a talk tomorrow, the 8th of July, Wednesday, titled Dante and the Hero's Quest for Healing. It's in the Junior Common Room at the Peterson Student Center at St. John's College. It's at 3:15. It's free and open to the public. There will be a Q&A afterwards, and Jim Bailey can also be found at his website. The book and his work can also be found at the website endofhealing.com. Jim, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte. It's been a pleasure.